Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
Attorney Andrew Seidel will dissect Supreme Court Justice Alito's shocking recent speech.
Then journalist and author Catherine Stewart will warn us why,
Trump or no Trump, religious authoritarianism is here to stay.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Patients with COVID-19 should not be given the antiviral drug remdesivir, the UN World Health Organization, WHO, has said. According to data from the WHO-led Global Solidarity Trial, there was no evidence that remdesivir had any important effect on people dying or reduced the need for ventilation or speeded up the time it took for them to get better. Nonetheless, WHO said that there was no proof that the antiviral had no benefit at all and stressed that further trials should continue into whether the drug might be useful for more vulnerable patients. Here's Dr. Janet Diaz, head of clinical care at WHO, speaking in Geneva.
We recommend a conditional recommendation, so I want to highlight that it's a conditional recommendation, against the use of remdesivir in hospitalized patients with COVID-19, regardless of disease severity. This did not prove that remdesivir does not have a benefit at all. You know, is there a subgroup that may benefit more, such as severe patients versus critical patients? Is there a timing in disease that may benefit more, such as early versus late?
Latest data from WHO indicates that 8 in 10 people infected with COVID report mild symptoms, while around 5% become critically ill. There are also reports of more persistent, longer-term symptoms, WHO said. More than 30,000 people have now fled Ethiopia's Tigray region to Sudan in just 2 weeks amid ongoing fighting, and the UN says that it is planning for as many as 200,000 to arrive. In an appeal for $200 million, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that about 45% of refugees were children under 18. Most people left their homes quickly and with nothing, although some had brought their animals, belongings and harvest, said UNICEF's Sudan representative, Abdullah Fadil. People were scared. We saw panic and fear in the eyes of many children, he told journalists, especially those who might have witnessed artillery fire or airplanes dropping bombs in reference to fighting between Ethiopian government and Tigray regional forces. Sudan already hosts more than 1.2 million refugees and 2 million internally displaced people. UN aid agencies have said that the number of people arriving in the country, some 4,000 to 5,000 a day, is unsustainable and potentially has serious repercussions for the whole region. To northwest Syria finally, where the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, has expressed alarm at disturbing reports of unlawful killings by de facto authorities and the continued detention of civilians, including humanitarian workers. OHCHR spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani also appealed for the release of a 28-year-old woman, Noor Al-Shallow, a humanitarian and media worker. She was detained by non-state group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in recent days. It confirmed that it was holding her on so-called moral and criminal charges. Ms. Shamdasani said that her family has not had any contact with her and that she may be at risk of execution. Noor Al-Shallow's case is among many others that the UN office has documented of individuals detained or abducted and executed in the northwest and other parts of Syria over the past year. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is radio for the rest of us, the heathens, the non-believers, the unorthodox, those of us who are personally free from religion. And, of course, we welcome everybody who wants to listen, is curious about this, and people who are interested in the support of separation of religion and government.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the November 19th, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio, and Annie, Laurie, and I again are hosting from our home studio in Madison, Wisconsin, while our engineer, Buzz Kemper, is producing in his own recording studio, Audio for the Arts, down near the Wisconsin State Capitol.
The Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which does two things. We work for separation of religion and government, just like our founders intended, and we work to educate the public, that's you, about the views of those of us who are non-believers and non-theists, and there's a lot of news to talk about that. And Dan, you have made up a new joke.
I did. This is a joke that I think Rodney Dangerfield would have told. This pandemic is nothing new. People were always crossing the street to avoid me before this.
I don't get no respect, you know what I mean, Dan?
Hey, Buzz, you sound just like Rodney Dangerfield.
Thank you.
He once came to Madison, Wisconsin. There was not a very good movie that was filmed.
Oh, yeah, that movie, Back to School.
Back to School
was filmed right here in Madison.
Maybe it was good. I can't remember.
I thought it was a funny movie. In the second half of today's show, we're going to talk with a journalist, Catherine Stewart. She's author of the book The Power Worshippers, that exposes Christian nationalism. We're going to talk to her about her New York Times column this week called Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay.
Yeah, very important warning for all of us. And we're glad that she'll be joining us. And then in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by FFRF's Director of Strategic Response, Andrew Seidel, who's an attorney, will tell us how the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito shocked the nation and shocked us by his speech last week to the Federalist Society and how that illustrates the vital need for court reform.
Next week is the anniversary of the birthday of the American composer Scott Joplin. He was born November 24, 1868. Scott Joplin, the king of ragtime, was a non-believer. Listen for Joplin's new rag, Swipesy, Maple Leaf Rag, and The Entertainer during today's show.
And also, November 25th, what is the birth date anniversary of my mother, Ann Nicole Gaylor, who was the principal founder of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, also of the Charitable Women's Medical Fund, the longest-lived abortion fund in the country. All volunteer, and you can donate to Women's Medical Fund Wisconsin if you find that online. And Anne was born in 1926 here in Wisconsin. And Dan, although she was very slender, she had quite a sweet tooth. And her birthday usually coincided with Thanksgiving. So while she loved pumpkin pie, she usually didn't get her cake. So we'll do something. When I make pie, I always think of my mother. When I make cake, I always think of her. So enjoy your pumpkin pie in Anne's honor.
So this is Free Thought Radio. We also have a TV show called Free Thought Matters that airs every Sunday around the country. And this Sunday, we are talking with the great-great-granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
And like her famous feminist ancestor, Colleen Jenkins is also an activist. She was largely responsible for getting the first statue of real women in New York City's Central Park on the centennial of the adoption of the 19th Amendment. That was August 26th. A statue showing Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Sojourner Truth. She had a lot more activism besides that.
And during our interview, which you can watch next Sunday, Colleen Jenkins told Annie Laurie how proud she was to be from such a free-thinking, forward-thinking, radical family.
Many of the things that my family did were 50, 60 years ahead of themselves, ahead of what was the flow of the nation. For instance, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, at the age of 32, was involved with convening the first Women's Rights Convention. And at that convention, they drew up 18 grievances, just like in the Declaration of Independence for America, where they had grievances against the King of England. Well, these women drew up their own Declaration of Independence, and their 18 grievances were against the patriarchy in the variety of ways I've already described. But she was a radical, not really knowing it.
So that's just a clip from Free Thought Matters, FFRF's TV show, and that episode is already viewable on YouTube. You can just go to FFRF YouTube, look for the playlist of Free Thought Matters, or Google Colleen Jenkins Free Thought Matters, and it'll come up. And of course, we talk a lot about Elizabeth Cady Stanton's views on religion, which were highly negative. She was the editor of the Woman's Bible. And you can also watch this show. We want to take it to the unmasked masses on Sunday mornings in 12 cities, Chicago, WPWRCW, Denver, KWGN, Houston, Cube, Independent, Los Angeles, KCOP, Madison, Wisconsin, WISC, Minneapolis, KSTC, New York City, WPIX. These are mostly independent stations. Phoenix, KASW, Portland, KRCW, Sacramento, KQCA, Seattle, Kong, and Washington, D.C., WDCW. It's mostly on early on Sunday mornings as an antidote to going to church. In Madison, Wisconsin, it's on at 11 p.m. on WISC. You can go to our website on FFRF.org under the news link. There's a drop-down, Free Thought Matters. You can review that to find out what time to see it if you happen to be in these cities, so you can spread the word or just watch it again on YouTube.
So even during this pandemic, maybe especially during the pandemic, our legal staff has been very, very busy fielding complaints about the violation of state-church separation. We've had a couple of victories this week from our 10 full-time attorneys. Chris Line wrote a letter to Georgia. A Georgia school district will now be reminding its staff members about their obligations to keep state and church separate. Fannin High School's football coach was regularly leading his team in prayer, we informed the school system. That's illegal. Athletic coaches are not supposed to engage in such activities. So we asked the district, Chris Line sent a letter asking the district to commence an investigation, take immediate action to stop any and all school-sponsored prayers occurring within any district athletic programs. And the school district was enlightened. The superintendent has met with the high school principal, and a plan is in progress to meet with all the coaches to discuss issues related to the First Amendment, including the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. So we count this as a victory.
That's what the district legal counsel said, right?
Yeah. And then in Kansas?
Well, in Kansas, we are getting a lot of flack from the ultra-right, you know, Breitbart, etc., because we had a victory in Pratt, Kansas. That's spelled P-R-A-T-T. And we got a complaint that the Liberty Middle School was participating in something called Operation Christmas Child. It's a charity project sponsored by Samaritan's Purse, and you may know that's a pervasively sectarian religious group headed by the zealous evangelist Franklin Graham. And we pointed out that their website says that their purpose is to follow Christ's command by going into to the aid of the world's poor, sick, and suffering, that these are it's a shoebox campaign of some sort, and it's intended to openly attract children in the developing world to convert to Christianity. So we said that it's honorable to do have a charitable intent to involve children in that, but they have to find something secular, not something religious like this. There are many secular charities to support that do not have this ulterior, predatory religious mission and proselytizing agenda. And so this was a teachable moment for the school district, and the superintendent recently responded that they are discontinuing the partnership with Operation Christmas Child, that they realized it is more sectarian in nature than they thought. And so we're delighted that they're stopping that. And again, we're all for these kinds of efforts in our public schools, so long as they are non-religious in nature, so long as they are not these religious zealots who are usually anti-LGBTQ anti-abortion, and they just want to get their clutches on small children in their minds. So,
and these religious groups can do their own advertising and fundraising outside of our public schools.
Yeah, so that was another victory for our intake attorney, Chris Line.
So we're going to take a break here. Stay tuned. After the break, FFRF's Director of Strategic Response will tell us about the shocking speech that U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito gave to the conservative Federalist Society last Friday.
And after that, we'll talk with the author and journalist Catherine Stewart, whose New York Times article ran this week, entitled "Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay." I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Garofalo, are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we have on the phone with us our Director of Strategic Response, who's an attorney, Andrew Seidel. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about this very chilling speech that Justice Alito gave to the Federalist Society last week, and you wrote the press release about that for FFRF. But before we talk about that, Andrew, do you want to tell us a little bit about what people might have missed if they didn't see Ask an Atheist yesterday, which is now up on our YouTube channel?
Yeah, great episode of Ask an Atheist. We had Seth Andrews of The Thinking Atheist on to talk about his new book, Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian. And we were really trying to get at the heart of what is happening in the country right now and how people don't seem to live in the same shared reality. It was a really fascinating conversation. We could have gone for 2 hours. We only went for about one, less than one. But really, people should tune in.
Because he was a former evangelical believer and a Christian radio show host, and so he knows it from the inside out. That was a great show.
So, yeah, you and our legal director, Rebecca Markert, were co-hosts.
And how can people see it?
They can go to FFRF's YouTube channel, and there's a playlist for Ask an Atheist, and you can sign up for it, too. So don't miss that show. So now, Andrew, turning to a grimmer topic, or I guess it's sort of the same topic, Justice Alito gave a speech last week. It was very shocking on Friday to the Federalist Society. And before we parse that speech and what it portends for our nation, can you tell us what is the Federalist Society?
Sure. It's sort of this ultra-conservative legal group of lawyers. It's sort of meant to be a collegial group for lawyers. But Trump and his administration outsourced the selection of federal judges to this ultra-conservative society. And last week, Alito essentially consummated that unholy union between the federal judiciary and the Federalist Society when he delivered that keynote address. It was really shocking.
So did the Supreme Court nominees come from them?
The almost all of the judicial nominees. We're going to have about 230 by the end of the appointments by the end of the week that Trump has pushed through. Almost all of them are members of the Federalist Society, and I believe all of them were selected and approved by the Federalist Society.
Pretty much Trump said that he was going to turn this over to the Federalist Society.
He said we're going to have great judges, conservative, all picked by the Federal Society. That's what he said. He said it.
So before we play a clip from this, can you kind of set this up? What was this speech by Justice Alito about? Where did he give it? When?
Yeah, I mean, this was just last week. And it's important for people to know this was not an off-the-cuff speech. This was recorded on video with graphics. He thought this through. He wanted to say these things. He wasn't scared. about saying these things. And he's talking about cases that are pending in the court. And this was the speech of an embittered, embattled minority fighting against an overwhelming majority, right? His views are now unpopular, and he knows it. But even though he's part of this shrinking demographic, the conservative white male Christian nationalist demographic, he's part of this 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court. And I really view this speech not just as a trial for Fox News, the way some people said, but as an admission, as a confession that even though their grasp on legislative power is slipping, Alito and his five buddies are going to help solidify and maintain that minority rule with their judicial power. It was deeply chilling.
Well, how can their grasp be slipping if they're appointing all these conservative justices and judges?
I mean, that's the way they're working to solidify that minority rule for a generation. And that's one of the reasons that at FFRF we are really looking to figure out a solution to fixing the court. The courts have already been packed. The courts have already been politicized. So we need to figure out a fix for that now.
So we have a few clips. So let's listen to this first clip, which I think was about Alito's skewed idea of religious liberty.
Just as the COVID restrictions have highlighted the movement toward rule by experts, litigation about those restrictions has pointed up emerging trends in the assessment of individual rights. This is especially evident with respect to religious liberty. It pains me to say this, but in certain quarters, religious liberty is fast becoming a disfavored right.
So, sounds like he's a persecuted minority. What does Alito mean when he uses the phrase religious liberty?
Yeah, I mean, at FFRF, we've been fighting and racing against this radical attempt to redefine religious liberty. And in Alito's fantasy, religious liberty requires the laws to exempt any conservative Christian who disagrees with that law, that Christians are allowed to discriminate as they see fit, that Christian views on same-sex marriage must be forced on the entire legal system, that Christians have a right to infect other citizens with a deadly virus. I mean, this is, it's not just the religious freedom aspect of this. He's redefining religious freedom while condemning public policy based on science and reason in the middle of a lethal pandemic. I mean, saying that we're being guided by experts is also just not true, right? I mean, if we were
well,
being
we
if
wish.
Our public policy, yeah, exactly. Huh. If our public policy was being guided by experts, we wouldn't have seen 250,000 Americans dead. But that's part of the problem, is that it's not being guided by experts.
So this whole idea of redefining religious liberty, just to belabor that a little bit, pretty much the phrase is using religious liberty as a sword rather than a shield, that this idea that it's persecuting and denying religious liberty, for example, if we have marriage equality, or, that you have to equally serve LGBTQ people who want to buy a cake as other people, that the Civil Rights Act, for example, doesn't really apply if you're a religious bigot,
or that churches have to comply with COVID restrictions. Their religious liberty is being hampered.
Exactly, and Alito was more clear about that in some of his later parts of the speech.
Well, this I think we have a clip next that talks about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Let's listen to that.
Consider where things stood in the 1990s. And to me, at least, that does not seem like the Jurassic Age. When a Supreme Court decision called Employment Division versus Smith cut back sharply on the protection provided by the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, Congress was quick to respond. It passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, to ensure broad protection for religious liberty.
So he sounds happy that Congress was quick to respond to fix what he thinks is a mistake. Does RFRA really protect religious liberty, Andrew?
I mean, it is one of the laws that worked to redefine it. To me, when I heard this, I was floored, because just 8 days before this speech, Alito participated in oral argument in a case called Bolton versus City of Philadelphia. And in that case, a Catholic organization is asking Alito and the other justices to overturn the very decision he just maligned, Employment Division versus Smith. He is talking about a case and an issue that is before the court.
They haven't decided on it yet.
It really was shocking. And under the, you know, under the federal statute and the code of conduct for United States judges, judges have to recuse themselves where their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And I mean, I have no doubt that Alito is completely partisan here. I bet a year of my salary in our press release that he's going to fine for the Catholic organization against the city just based on this speech alone.
And of course, FFRF had an amicus brief in that case, and this is about the – well, do you want to briefly say what that case is about, Andrew?
Yeah, this is about a Catholic organization that vets foster families for the city of Philadelphia, and they refuse to vet any same-sex couples, excluding them from the potential pool of parental foster families. And then they also said they have not only a right – to do that based in religious freedom, they have a right also to contract with the city to provide those services based in religious freedom. So, I mean, just a wild expansion and redefinition of the religious liberty, just like we were talking about earlier.
Well, shouldn't we ask Alito to recuse himself?
I think he should be asked to do that. And I just want to mention, too, because I said that the federal statute and the code of conduct that applies to judges would require that, I believe. Neither of those apply to the Supreme Court. We rely on the justices of the Supreme Court's personal ethics and their moral code to guide them on whether to recuse themselves.
So let's listen to the last clip. We're out of time here, Andrew. Let's listen to the last clip we have of Alito here.
You can't say that marriage is a union between one man and one woman. Until very recently, that's what the vast majority of Americans thought. Now it's considered bigotry. That this would happen after our decision in Obergefell should not have come as a surprise. Yes, the opinion of the court included words meant to calm the fears of those who cling to traditional views on marriage. But I could see, and so did the other justices in dissent, where the decision would lead.
So, quick response, Andrew. We're almost out of time.
I mean, the religious bigots getting called out for bigotry is bigotry in Alito's adult world. You know, I mean, and I'm deeply, deeply concerned about what this means for the future of marriage equality in the United States.
Well, thank you. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us to talk about this chilling speech by Justice Alito and what we need to do about it.
And I think your job is secure here, Andrew, for the next few years with the religious right doing what it's doing. Thank you again.
I guess that's a silver lining. Thank you.
After the break, we're going to switch gears here and talk about the same topic in a different way. We're going to talk with the author and journalist, Catherine Stewart, about her article this week in the New York Times called "Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay." I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Catherine Stewart is a leading authority on the politics of the religious right. We've talked with Catherine a number of times on this show, including about her book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. She contributes to the New York Times, the American Prospect, the Washington Post, the Nation, the Guardian, the Advocate, Slate, the Atlantic. I don't think there's any other magazines left to contribute to, are there?
And Catherine Stewart's newest book is The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. And we've had Catherine on the show to talk about that new book. And then on Monday, just this week, November 16th, the New York Times printed her article, published her article, entitled Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay. So thank you for writing this very important piece, Catherine, and thank you for joining us again on Free Thought Radio.
It's great to speak with you again. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Catherine, many of us have been breathing a sigh of relief since the election, thinking we've dodged the bullet, that the worst is over, we'll get our country back to normal. Then you wrote this very important cautionary tale, this op-ed in the New York Times, warning us, hey, the Christian nationalists are still planning to win the war. We may have lost this. They may have lost this one battle. So a very important piece. And this briefly, tell us the thesis of this piece.
Sure. The question is, now that Trump has lost, will Christian nationalists rethink their illiberal politics? And I argue, not likely. Well, the movement seems determined to reinterpret defeat at the top of the ticket as evidence of its own persecution and its own righteousness, and appears determined to sort of continue with the illiberal politics that they have demonstrated over time, and certainly that the president, outgoing president, has so ably embodied.
So your piece, early in this New York Times op-ed, you do talk a little bit about the preliminary data on the election and how the religious right, the Christian nationalists, voted. Can we talk about that first?
Sure. I mean, speaking broadly of those who Biden picked up a number of voters, the Biden-Harris ticket, but so did Trump, and overwhelmingly among people who identify at least loosely with Christian nationalism, or the idea that America is and ought to be a Christian nation governed under a reactionary understanding of the Christian religion. So, the early polls are notoriously unreliable, but several have come in. They all seem to confirm what Edison research showed, which is that 28% of voters identified as either white evangelical or white born-again Christian. And of those, 76% voted for Trump. But that doesn't even capture the number of Christian nationalists that voted for Trump. I think most pollsters shoehorn very complex religious identities into these broad labels, so they fail to separate out the different strands of Mr. Trump's support. For instance, hyper-conservative Catholics, members, people who subscribed to a sort of subset of Pentecostal and charismatic Christians, and others also voted for Trump, and they often did so because they were encouraged to vote their so-called biblical values by leaders of the Christian nationalist movement and by some of the sort of hyper-conservative pastors that are involved in the leadership of the movement. And so, that cohort is fairly unshakable. I think we can look to the work of a pollster like George Barna. He's an evangelical pollster who's very deeply involved with the movement, but his data is often very, very good. He pointed out that in 2016, the most devoted religious right supporters, the most sort of devoted Christian national supporters, number just 10% of the population, but 91% voted in 2016, and of those, 93% voted for Mr. Trump. So you can see that it doesn't really take a majority of the population to dominate in elections. All it takes is a really devoted, extremely loyal, extremely organized, disproportionately organized minority of the population to dominate in these election cycles.
So, Pew came up with statistics just before the election saying that the seculars, the nuns and the seculars, are also 28% of the population of voters, 28% of voters. But I haven't seen yet, maybe you have, results on how we all voted. But one thing that's changed, just tiny change, is if those preliminary polls are right, in 76% of so-called, this umbrella group of Christian nationalists, evangelicals, voted for Trump. That's down slightly from 2016, where it was, 80 or 81%? Just a tiny change.
It's interesting. I mean, the fact is that, the numbers may vary slightly, and as we all know, elections are often won at the margins. We also have to notice that this is, our politics unfortunately favors a disproportionately empowered minority. Trump lost the popular vote twice, and the first time it was not by enough. He still won the election this time. He lost the popular vote, I think, by an even greater number. But we do have a political system that gives disproportionate power to immensely organized, engaged, and loyal minority, and one of their most reliable strategies for producing that absolutely unshakable cohort has been, of course, to get them to agree on, for instance, that abortion is the easy answer to every difficult political policy question. So leaders of the movement know that if they can get people to vote on a single issue, they can control their vote. So they devote enormous resources in getting people to sort of understand that voting a certain way on abortion or, say, some of the LGBT issues and the like is a way to sort of reflect their so-called biblical values when at the ballot box.
So, Catherine, you were recently invited by some members of Congress, specifically the Congressional Freethought Caucus, to address them about the growing influence of the religious right. And we got to see that talk, amazing talk. And in it, you pointed out that the religious right or Christian nationalists don't really have like a centralized hub or head, but they are really well funded. Who's funding this religious right movement?
The movement is funded by a large number of hyper wealthy individuals, often belonging to members of extended families, that are as invested in sort of this sort of far right wing, economic wing of the Republican Party, like a libertarian economic ideology. And they need the so-called values voters in order to lock down their economic agenda of low taxation for the hyper-wealthy, minimal regulation of business, minimal regulation of environment and the like. So these donors include, among many, many others, the DeVos Prince family, the fracking billionaire Wilkes brothers, members of the Green family, whose Hobby Lobby fortune helped build the Museum of the Bible, and the like. A lot of these families donate to what they call donor-advised funds, like the National Christian Foundation, which distributed, I think it's like $1.5 billion in 2018. I mean, they just have enormous resources that they disperse to a large number of right-wing causes, like, the Alliance Defending Freedom or the Family Research Council or things like that. You can see these foundations, these family foundations or individuals donating the money, but then once it enters a donor-advised foundation, it's like you can't really trace it from point A to point B. But many of the other big donors, many of which I describe in my book, The Power Worshippers, when you look at the tax documents for the organizations they're donating to, you can kind of see where the money is going. Sometimes you can really trace it. I did spend a lot of time in The Power Worshippers tracing some of the funding from the DeVos Prince family to many of the libertarian organizations, right-wing think tanks, educational choice organizations that are determined to weaken public education and the like.
So we are talking with Catherine Stewart. She is author of the book The Power Worshippers, about the rise of Christian nationalism, and we're talking with her about her cautionary article in the New York Times this week, Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay. I'm Annie Laurie Gellar.
I'm Dan Barker. We have to take a break, but we'll come right back with more of Catherine Stewart.
Yeah, we'll talk about the judiciary and minority rule, too.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're continuing our conversation with Catherine Stewart, the journalist whose newest book is called The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. We're talking about her cautionary op-ed in this week's New York Times, Trump or No Trump, Religious Authoritarianism is Here to Stay. And thanks for staying with us, Catherine.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And during the break, I narrowed in on a particular paragraph in your op-ed that I was wondering if you could read for all of us.
Sure. While many outsiders continue to think of Christian nationalism as a social movement that operates from the ground up, it is in fact a political movement that operates mostly from the top down. The rank and file of the movement is diverse and has an infinite variety of motivations and concerns, but the leaders are far more unified, and they collaborate in a densely interconnected network of think tanks, policy groups, activist organizations, legal advocacy groups, and conservative pastoral networks. What holds them together is not any centralized command structure, but a radical political ideology that is profoundly hostile to democracy and pluralism, and a certain political style that seeks to provoke moral panic, rewards the paranoid, and views every partisan conflict as a conflagration at the end of the world. Partisan politics is the lifeblood of their movement.
Yeah, quite a summary of Christian nationalism and the religious right now, this rewarding the paranoid and viewing every conflict as a conflagration. So, Catherine, you talk about underlying structural realities. We talked a little bit about who's funding the Christian nationalists and religious right, you know, like the DeVos family, the Green family, I guess we didn't talk about from
Hobby Lobby.
And you talk about growing economic inequality and how that figures into this. Do you want to briefly comment on that?
Sure. I think that the rank and file has these very arduously cultivated resentments. Movement leaders communicate the issues that they should care about, and that's been turned into a fundraising bonanza for them. But also the fact that we have this sort of record levels of economic inequality. I'm not just talking about, we always have, different distributions of wealth in our society, but right now it's sort of at a record, and that's, and this is not an opinion, this is something that's been very well documented by sociologists and economists, and that has produced a number of folks at the very top, not all folks, obviously, there are many folks at the top who are devoted to other causes, but if you look at members, sort of some of the big donors of the religious right, they want to sort of maintain a lot of their share of the wealth. They also want to maintain low taxation for business, low government regulation, minimal environmental regulations, and so they, in order to sort of enact those types of economic policies, they know that they're going to need to get the base to vote for the hyper-conservative candidates that the movement favors, but it's much easier to get them to vote on things like abortion or so-called protecting the traditional family. It's interesting. The religious right casts itself as, a family that's out there to protect family concerns and interests, but the politicians they favor are enacting policies that make it so much harder for American families to succeed. But there are other factors in sort of this development of this Christian national space, and I think we can't underestimate the influence of the right-wing propaganda sphere. Like, Christian nationalism is the creation of a very particularly hermetic messaging sphere. It makes it really hard for those on the outside to reach them, to impact the Christian nationalist base. Members of the rank and file get a lot of their political information, not just from messaging platforms that keep their audiences in a world that is completely divorced from reality, but also from dedicated religious networks and reactionary faith leaders. And I think that's one of the reasons that Mr. Trump was able to hold on to such a high percentage of his votes in the face of such overwhelming evidence of malfeasance.
So how many of them are listening to this show, for example?
Not too many. So are you talking about more than Fox TV? What are those messaging
platforms? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Fox is just the beginning. It's just sort of a gateway. You know, I mean, there's just so many other propaganda outlets, you know, thinking about places like, you know, Breitbart or One America News Network or Epic. There's like all these different, there's a kind of whole massive right-wing messaging sphere. And if you sort of just are tuning into that, then you would just think Mr. Trump is fantastic.
So, you know, some people are saying that they're almost like, well, just like stand by and stand ready. His comment during the debate, Trump's comment, that he has this cadre of true believers that he might be calling on soon if he really wants to make a lot of trouble.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think the trouble is not so much, like if you're looking at the big picture, the trouble is not so much among those folks. I think the real challenge is that what he's setting up is a politics of total obstruction. And I think that's really going to prove thorny for our democracy. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, the stolen election meme that he's pushing, mm-hmm. it's not going to take him back into the Oval Office. But the sort of birther narrative that they threw at President Barack Obama never ejected him out of the office. What it did is it laid the groundwork for the politics of obstruction, where it makes it very difficult for a president to get anything done whatsoever, especially now with the other branches up for grabs. We have to see how things work out in Georgia. But let's remember, even when former President Obama, nominated Merrick Garland, by all standards, a sort of conservative Democrat, a very moderate justice for the Supreme Court, they wouldn't even hold a hearing. This is like more than a year out of the election. They said, oh, no, we've got to hold that seat. And that's just, that's just not fair play.
Well, that's just honest.
That's
why
many of us are saying there has to be, this is unprecedented, there has to be court correction. There has to be something that is done about this because we're dealing, well, as you say, the Republicans have long known that the judiciary is the most effective instrument of minority rule. And we have about 3 minutes left. Could you talk a little bit more about what's going on with the judiciary and this minority rule?
Well, Mr. Trump's success in packing the federal judiciary will be one of his most devastating legacies and will affect us for perhaps a generation. He, as of this moment, I think he's got 220 federal judges, including 3 Supreme Court justices. There's a whole slate of others, I think, just on the horizon, that he's trying to push through right now. And, leaders of the movement know that if you can get the courts, you can get the policies that you want enacted. A lot of folks thought during the Obama years that Christian nationalism or the religious right wasn't a factor when I started writing about this movement 10 years ago. I was met with disbelief. They're like, oh, that's a Bush era. This doesn't mm-hmm. matter. They're gone. But in those years, even during the Obama years, they made tremendous gains through the courts by being, enormous financial investment in organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Federalist Society, the judicial strategy that you guys know so much about because you've been involved in so many of those cases. So what they do is they're very strategic. They bring the right cases to the right courts, and they put into place these novel legal building blocks that will eventually build up to a big win. And by doing so, they can really change the way our laws govern our country. We've seen a total diminishment of the Establishment Clause, a sort of evisceration of the Establishment Clause.
Yes. We got 1 minute left. Catherine, can I ask you what you think about court correction and balancing?
Well, I think before we think about that, we really have to think about, what's coming next, and that runoff in Russia is, I'm sorry, in Russia,
Georgia.
In Georgia is really important. So I think it's really important for us to, you know, instead of sort of wringing our hands here, we should really be spending our time organizing our communities, registering new voters, and supporting candidates who reflect the values that uplift everyone, the values of equality, pluralism, and church-state separation. And we should also try to, the degree possible, protect our fellow Americans from lies and conspiracies that are endemic in the right-wing political ecosystem.
So, Catherine, just we've got a half minute left. Are you working on a new book, or what's new for you?
Oh, I'm still working on various writings and promoting this book and working on a number of articles. This is unfortunately an endlessly interesting movement, because it's a movement that has played a decisive influence in our politics.
Well, your book and your article in the New York Times this week couldn't be more timely, and we are looking forward to hearing you speak, we hope, in person at FFRF's convention in Boston next November. And you've also agreed to interview Margaret Atwood, who is one of the speakers we have lined up, and that is going to be a fascinating, fascinating hour that none of us is going to want to miss.
I know. She's Handmaid's Tale is looking increasingly prescient. It's still sort of metaphorical, but it's very interesting.
Well, thank you, Catherine. We're out of time.
Thank you so much. We'll be in touch.
And that's our show for today. We want to thank you, Buzz Kemper, for producing the show. And we want to thank you, listeners in Philadelphia, to WOOM. Here in Madison, Wisconsin, to WIDE and WMUU. In southern Wisconsin, down in Janesville, WADR Community Radio. And hello to listeners for many years to KEOS in Central Texas, a college station where Texas A&M is, to KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, to WOOL, I love this name, Black Sheep Radio in Bellows Falls, Vermont, to WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And if you're one of the many thousands of podcast listeners, give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell your friends to visit us at ffrf.org/radio.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or join us in our work to educate the public about the importance of separation between religion and government and represent the views of those of us who are secular. FFRF is the nation's largest association of atheists, agnostics, and other non-believers, and we work diligently as a state church watchdog. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.